Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have Kim Thanos. Kim is the founder and CEO of Lumen Learning. Kim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So why don't we kick things off with an overview of Lumen Learning. Would love to know what problem you're solving in the marketplace.
Thank you. We create a solution that replaces college textbooks. It's a digital solution, and we're really focused in the college courses that we would call gateway courses. So those are courses that every college student has to take and the courses that students are most likely to fail. So the core of our product is to really understand how we can help students learn better in those courses to increase their chances of success when they take those courses. So it's really a focus on helping students be successful in their first year of college who likely would not otherwise.
Okay. And what was the inspiration behind starting the company?
Really, we were coming at this when we first started the company. We had formed a collaborative that received a grant from the Gates Foundation, and they had asked us to focus on a specific challenge. And the challenge was, how can we improve success for at-risk students using open content or openly licensed materials similar to open source software, something that carries a Creative Commons license? And when we started to do that, there were a number of things that kind of that opened up. One of them was we could bring price way down. And so what we found with that was that when we went in to talk to faculty members, particularly at community colleges, we would talk about the impact of textbook cost on their students. And we're able to pull together some research that said students were taking fewer classes because of textbook costs. They were more likely to drop their courses because of textbook costs. And in many cases, students were making a choice between food, rent, gas, and textbooks. And textbooks are not going to win there. And so we came into this market, and I would say we're kind of classic disruptors. We came into the market with a product that was dramatically inferior than what faculty members were using. But while faculty members at that point, our pricing was $5 per student per course versus what might be at that in those days, $180 to $200.
Right.
For the textbook. And so faculty members were really willing to work with us because their view was, my students are just flat out not buying. So something that just gets materials in the hands of my students, even if it's not as good, is better than nothing. And
sure.
So then we were able to work with the faculty members to just gradually innovate, understand exactly what was needed next to give them the teaching resources they needed, what was needed next to give the students the resources they needed to be successful. And we were able to iterate the product, bringing in the kind of improvements we needed to achieve the mission, but not adding all this extra cost that the legacy providers had in print textbooks, inventory costs, all of these other things that they'd built in, even some of the content royalties. We were just very, very specific about making sure we kept our cost structure really low and only brought in costs that really made sense to achieve the goals of the product. And we're able to really out-innovate. And so today our pricing is $35 per student, which is still far below the market rate, but we've really been able to make sure that $35 is hitting right on the nose to achieve product market fit and achieve the goals of the learning materials.
Fantastic. I think I may be able to infer the answer, but I don't want to assume. So for the benefit of our audience, who makes the textbook purchasing decision? Is it the faculty or the school?
I mean, we're very similar to a prescription drug. So the faculty members prescribe our product to their students and the students purchase. That is true in most cases. We do have one very large customer, and then a few smaller that use a different model. The SUNY system, the State University of New York, does a, has paid for a kind of site license for all of their colleges and universities. So our materials are freely available to all of the students and faculty members in the SUNY system. But that's an unusual model, and they were able to do that with support from the New York legislature for some funding that was designed to help reduce textbook cost. But in most cases, a faculty member in their course syllabus, they'll say to students, instead of it saying, go buy this textbook, it says, we'll be using the Lumen Learning materials. And so students know that they need to either go to the bookstore and get a code to access the materials, or they can just dive right into their learning management system and they can pay us directly with a credit card.
Got it. Makes good sense. So, a little bit of, if we can take a step back. So you
Sure.
mentioned the grant from the Gates Foundation. Would love to know what your experience was leading up to seeing the grant and starting Lumen Learning.
Yeah. Many years ago, when I was a child, I worked in higher education technology during really the late 90s period, where so much of the kind of web enablement of everything was going on, but we were seeing that in education. So I was part of a startup called Campus Pipeline, and Campus Pipeline's focus was connecting into these big enterprise systems to web enable things like drop ad or registration or all of these things that at that point were kind of go stand in line to get them done. And that brought me into education. I was with them really until they were acquired by a larger company, and I left to do my own consulting work. And so I had just a small boutique consulting firm that did a lot of work around go-to-market in higher education. And a lot of our work was really bringing groups together to help better inform the design of these large, complex software systems, so that when they were released to institutions, they actually met the need instead of requiring quite so much customization. So a lot of work with that, a lot of work on the sales and marketing side, building communities, building go-to-market capability. In doing that, I always had my eyes open for like different new opportunities, because I did have an idea that probably at some point I wanted to move out of a consulting advising role and into an operator mode of creating something that was sustainable. And I think I was like, it was the perfect timing for that. I was starting to get antsy around that. I sometimes got frustrated that I would bring forward a strategy that I was really excited about. By the time it was really implemented by the organization I was working with, it was unsatisfying. And so I was like, I really want the chance to take some of these things over the finish line. And the Gates Challenge Grants came out. I had a chance to do a very small challenge grant to test this out. And as I was moving through that, it was really clear to me that while we were running this like a one-time project, it was not. And when I looked at the different ways that that could scale, that that could make a larger impact, truthfully, in that time, the Gates Foundation had said, we are doing a bunch of small bets with these very small grants, and we are going to double down on the more successful ideas and give more funding to the more successful ideas. And I'm very competitive. And so, like, we were absolutely going to win that competition to be
Absolutely.
one of the double down grants. And so we felt like we had just done everything right, and we reapplied to the Gates Foundation and they turned us down. And I was super angry about that. But I called to get feedback from a few different folks, and one of the program officers said to me, Kim, we invite you to reapply. But you guys were basically kind of saying, we'll put up, because what we, I didn't feel like I could say to the Gates Foundation, we're going to create a company. So what I said is, we'll put together some like self-paced resources to help institutions do this. And then my idea was, and we'll create a company to support that. And the program officer said to me, Kim, what you basically proposed is putting up a pretty good website to change education. And we've funded put up a pretty good website many times, and it has that effect 0% of the time. Never works. And so go back and figure out what you guys did right with this small, we worked with seven colleges, what you did with those seven colleges, and tell us what funding you need to do with many more. And I said, well, I think what's needed is to create an entity that can actually make this into more of a product than a service, provide the support that's needed, sustain this work over time. And he said, well, that's an interesting idea. I think if you submitted that as a proposal, we would be much more interested in funding that. And so we did. And that kind of gave us some seed funding to really start moving to that next level of figuring out how do you productize this? How do you make this a repeatable, scalable, sustainable product entity approach? And I think that like little extra push did make us think bigger in a more accelerated way in that time frame.
You know, as I'm listening to this, so kudos for you, I think, for going back and asking, well, why didn't we get the follow-on grant? And I, you know, for members of our audience, you know, especially, you know, the entrepreneurs, I mean, you didn't need a, you know, a perfect example where you need to engage stakeholders. I mean, I don't know if it gets better than that. All right, so they share their feedback. You know, you have a vision now for productizing this. How many years has Women Learning been in operations?
We founded the company at the end of 2012.
Okay, wow.
We're 12 years in, almost 13 years in.
Fantastic. Okay, so let's talk about the first couple of years. You know, what were some of the key takeaways that you learned as you started to lay the foundation for the business?
So I think the first 2.5 years, we continued to do this work as more of a service. So, you know, and I'll give you an example of what that looked like. So for, say, an English composition course, we would work with a small group of faculty members to say, how would we create these materials and have just the right solution for you in your English composition course? And then we would take that to another college or university, and we would share it with them, and they would say, well, that doesn't work for us because blank. So you'd say, excellent. So let's talk about what you need. How can we continue to evolve these? And so really it was kind of groups of faculty members at a time iterating on this idea and what we'd created. And I'll tell you the most useful portion of that from a quality of life perspective, it was the worst, but from a product innovation perspective, it was the best. Was part of our grant funding funded me to go to 30 institutions around the country and work through this process with them. And so I was just on a plane for a year. But the nice thing about that was that I had the opportunity to have faculty members kind of open up their laptop or get onto their computer, pull this up, and I literally was looking over their shoulder, watching them navigate through this work that we'd created. And so I could see where they would get excited. I could see where folks were confused. It was very clear kind of where we were losing people. And so we kept kind of, in some ways, we are making things like more robust and at the same time really simplifying. And, you know, we quickly saw that we were working in kind of two different approaches. In our math platform, we were bringing in a standalone platform. In the non-quantitative courses, we were integrating the courses into a platform that kind of competed with the institutional learning management system. And the math platform, we had much more success. So it really moved us toward, you know, we need everything in one platform that can work with the institutional systems that are already in place. Sure, a range of kind of learnings like that. Anytime there was duplicating functionality, you just watch people spiral.
Right.
And so that was incredibly valuable. So we used that really to get through this proof of concept. We were getting to the end of that. Our grant funding was gone by that point. We were kind of, you know, taking service engagement kind of dollars and working with institutions around this. And that was the point where we were really ready to launch this next level of product development. And it just worked out timing-wise. There was another Gates Foundation grant. And so we applied for that one. That was also kind of a competitive application process, and we won that grant. And at that point, we made a decision to raise some more traditional capital at the same time. And the idea was the Gates Foundation was really going to fund R&D, but they weren't
Sure.
any overhead. They weren't going to fund any sales and marketing. They weren't, there was a, so we had the mindset that was like, if we take this R&D funding and we couple that, and that's really focused on impact. How can we achieve this mission of improving success rates for students? And then at the same time, bring some funding in that's really all about scale, efficiency and scale. And so we were able to bring that together. So that's, we raised a round of seed capital at that same time. And we were waffling on that a lot because that kind of idea of, is this, when you raise your first capital, it dramatically changes the pressure and expectations around achieving the results that that capital's invested to achieve.
Sure.
But it did seem like at that time we were poised to be able to bring this together. We could get there faster with some additional capital, and we liked the balance of having some grant funding that was more impact driven and some traditional investment that was more scale and efficiency driven. And I think that tension really served us very well. It really helped us, have to pay attention on both sides and be accountable on both sides.
I'm curious that year you spent on the plane. Do you feel like you would have had the success that you've had since you started the company had you not been eye to eye with your customers?
No way, no way. It just, and even today, like I feel like you look at that now and say, but now folks are much more adept at, that was like 2015, 20, about 2015, so about 10 years ago. Now people are much more adept at having a video conferencing. Like we've really found that for our demos, we actually do much better with a demo over Zoom than we do a demo on campus because we want everybody kind of looking at the screen, and you can do that in a more intimate way if you're sitting at your desk than if you're in a big room full of people looking at a screen. But we needed that interaction. We didn't just need to present something. We needed to watch folks try to use it. And we needed also to like have the chance. At that point, we were really trying to create this kind of groundswell of change that said textbook costs matter. And that was a little bit of a hard sell at that time because a lot of times faculty members honestly didn't know how much the textbook cost was for their students. They weren't paying it, and they very rarely got direct information from the sales folks they were working with on exactly what it was going to cost. And so there was a lot of this that was helping us educate that. And so when you're trying to kind of change hearts and minds, we needed to have people want to see this change happen. And then we needed to provide something that gave them enough that they felt good about making that change and felt like the quality and reliability was where it needed to be. So it was both a kind of an intellectual decision and an emotional decision, and we needed both sides of that. So I
Right.
think the product market fit was important, but I think also, the conversations we had over dinner, had over a drink where a faculty member was saying, "Oh, it's been so painful to watch this happen," or "I love you guys and I want to see you win and think this change should happen, but here are my reservations that I might not talk about when I'm in a room with my peers." So I think that kind of experience for us really influenced the culture of the company, influenced our product development processes, influenced how we think about the problem we're solving for faculty members. And so it was incredibly valuable. It was challenging, but yeah, I don't think we could have gotten there any other way.
Fantastic. No, it definitely sounds like it's a win-win, and it's a reoccurring theme, that this success is predicated on just knowing who you're serving. And you're right. I mean, sometimes you don't get the hard feedback. So if you're willing to go meet someone face to face, I mean, brilliant. You mentioned the financing round. Would love to know how deliberate the effort was. And by that, I mean, were you, given this was your first round, were you happy to, have any investor on your cap table, or did you feel really strong that you needed to make sure that there was strong alignment on the vision?
I would have told you at the time that I felt like it was really important that there was alignment around the vision, partially because we're a pretty mission impact focused company. I don't think I could have told you exactly what that meant at that time. And I think it's one of the things that I always kind of share with prospective founders is, I mean, I've been at this now 12 years. We've raised three rounds of capital. We've dealt with multiple private foundations through all of this and, you know, scaled the team. And you don't have to know how to do all of that when you found your company. You need to know the next, you know, the first set of steps and have some broader view of where you're trying to go. And then there's just a lot of learning. And so, you know, that first round, we knew we wanted the capital and we were navigating kind of how, where we were seeing interest. But I really wasn't kind of going on the road pitching any VC I could get a meeting with. You know, we initially had some interest from Portland Seed Fund. We're based in Portland, Oregon. So from Portland Seed Fund, also from the Oregon Angel Fund. And once we started working with those two parties, they made a lot of connections for us, and we did our seed round almost exclusively with angels. And some of those were angels who'd invested in higher education, who were in our network, and some of those were these funds. I think we ended up with funds, the Cascade group out of Bend, Oregon. We had Portland Seed Fund, Oregon Angel Fund, and the Alliance of Angels out of Seattle. We're all in that initial seed fund. And the angels matched up really well with us because they do have a tendency to be individuals who care about how the world will be a better place with the success of their investments, in addition to wanting the return. So you see more double bottom line investors. I think though that I wasn't quite clear at that point of what are the trade-offs of us not having a fund, a venture fund with follow-on capital, in really early. Since then, Oregon Angel Fund has transitioned to become Oregon Venture Fund, and they do more follow-on investments. But at that point, by having all angels, you know, we really were saying our next round is going to have to be a different funder. There's not really going to be follow-on capital that comes in from this group, although that group of angels has been very good to us. And so, you know, has continued to participate in later rounds and has continued to be very flexible with the company in periods where funding's been pretty challenging.
And with these groups, what kind of sense can you give us to in terms of hands-on, hands-off, or any type of support?
Yeah, so Oregon Angel Fund took a board seat. They filled that board seat. The guy who'd helped us lead through the due diligence, Brad Zanger, who, you know, is a former kind of founding team member and had been through his whole experience and brought that to the table. He joined our board initially and continues to be on the board today. So I think one of the benefits we have had is having a board member who's really been through the whole growth process with us to have that consistency. Which has been very nice with other changing board roles to have them there. But I will say, you know, that type of funding group, you know, one of the benefits you get with a group of angels is it is, you know, in my experience, it's been very founder friendly. And even as I've gone to them at kind of inflection points and said, you know, here's a possible path forward in terms of either liquidity or additional investment or something we've been struggling with that's non-capital related. The first question always is, you know, where are you landing on this, Kim? So, you know, they're generally looking to guide their founders to make good decisions, but to support the founders in the decisions they make. And that's a very comfortable structure. You know, it feels very supportive. I don't feel like I've ever gone to my angel investors or the angel funds and said, I need help in this area, and have them say, that's not an area of expertise for us. They have a very large network, and they really work to flex that network to make connections, to provide access to expertise. It's they've been a really, really nice group of initial investors.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's interesting over the course of the inception of the podcast and then just in the work that we do for FinStrat and talking to founders, you generally hear, hey, please let me focus on the company. If I need your help, I'll ask. To, hey, if you can provide support by making introductions or providing counsel on a question I may have. Great. So, it sounds like, that's been your experience. And I think that's fantastic that you can find investors who can support you like that.
They've been great.
Fantastic. So, we're coming up on 13 years, and your company's experienced a tremendous amount of success. Would love to know over the years how you've thought about allocating budget between product development and sales and marketing. Specifically, has your mentality been more, if I can invest in our offering, I know buyers will come? Or do you feel like, notwithstanding the fact that I feel like I have an amazing product, I still have to make sure that I'm spending dollars and getting the word out so that the rest of the college and university system knows this exists?
Yeah, I think we've been through a few phases of new product launches. So, we actually just in 2024 launched a new platform offering that we're kind of moving forward with our next generation. And in each one of these kind of step ups in platform product capability, there's been a different level of experience and kind of learning from the last phase. So what we do now, which I think is much more effective than where we were before, which was a little more faith-based, is you have to keep investing in product until you've got product market fit. And there's this kind of tension there because you don't know you have product market fit until the market tells you you have it. So you've got to get it into market early. You've got to iterate with it early. But it's also true that some percentage of people are only going to look at you once.
Mm-hmm.
If they evaluate the product and it's not product market fit, you're not getting them back. And so we've really tried to say, we're going to market, we're getting this into the hands of faculty members, into some classrooms early. We're getting faculty feedback, we're getting student feedback, but we're not really going to push super hard on the sales and marketing side until we know that we've got something here that's hitting. And, it's enough data points that we can say, okay, this group of faculty members are going to be happy with this, but we still have these issues. How do we market to this group? What we're still addressing? Maybe a missed feature, or what has a tendency to hit us is how much flexibility do faculty members want to do their own customization and revisions of things. And then on the sales and marketing side, we've settled on the same piece, which is, what tactics and approaches in getting the word out and creating credibility and building that momentum are actually working. And for us, it's kind of different in different disciplines. It can be different with different platforms. And so we try not to waste a lot of sales and marketing spend on something that hasn't been proven out to work in our experimentation.
Yeah.
And so that's been the balance. So we've got to like prove that we have product market fit and then really iterate on the sales and marketing side to say, and this is the way we take this to market, the institutions we're targeting, the messages and features that are making the difference in this discipline, but to also do some experimentation around that before we push too much into it. But it's very balanced. The spending balance is different over time, a little more in product and a little less in sales and marketing, and then it kind of tips the other way, but it has a tendency to go back and forth a bit and balance out pretty closely.
So what's your yardstick for feedback? Is it just talking with your end users and getting their perspective, or do you use any objective metrics?
The best metric we have is our win rate.
Hmm.
So it's how things are moving down the funnel. Like when we engage, when we reach out to institutions with our initial messaging, are we getting the responses we need there? When we get into active selling, are we keeping people engaged and able to move them forward? And then when it comes down to especially larger decisions, when we get in front of a committee that's going to make a decision on behalf of all of the faculty in the department, are we winning those committee evaluations? And it's not uncommon that we can get through those first two cycles and be like, we're here, we have product market fit. But when you get to the committee decisions, there's a much broader population involved. And some of those early adopter kind of innovator mindsets that are giving the early feedback are different than the folks who are looking for a reason not to change.
Mm-hmm.
And so they need something different. And so really, when we're trying to use a quantitative objective data to evaluate product market fit, at the end of the day, you're winning or you're losing. And no matter how many nice things you're hearing from users, if they're not actually adopting, you don't have product market fit. So that's where we've tried to kind of keep ourselves honest there. And the same's true on sales tactics. My team often, one of the things that we argue about internally is it's easy for sales and marketing folks to get excited about an event strategy where we're going to go to these events where lots of our decision makers are gathering and everybody has a great time and we make lots of great connections. And it's a big difference between somebody letting you buy them dinner and somebody adopting your product. And so, can we really look at the numbers and say, this is making sense? Because when we have those conversations, it leads to sales results. So.
Yeah, it's a great way to characterize it. Often you think about the beginning innings of a founder starting their company and whether or not a buyer will give them money for what they have. But as you just pointed out, I mean, a lot of innings in the game. And why not continue to use that as a benchmark before you double down on a sales and marketing initiative? I love it. Artificial intelligence has been a big topic. Since OpenAI released ChatGPT, would love to get your perspective on how you're thinking about the technology and if you've started to incorporate it in your offering, what's that look like so far?
Yeah, so the fastest impact in my team of generative AI was it changing our workflows internally and how we create product. And some of that is just the speed at which we could do multiple iterations of the same work. So you can imagine, when we're creating learning materials to teach, say standard deviation. In the past, we really You would want to come up with one or two really good examples. And what we're able to do now is come up with any number of examples that might align with different students' interests. So, for some students, it's like, oh, we should use a sports example. That'll make it, bring it into something they understand. Truthfully, you test that out with students, and somebody comes back and is like, yeah, I don't really understand basketball. And so I have to now learn basketball in order to learn standard deviation. And so, so we're not limited in that way anymore. We can really churn out examples much faster. The quality of the content development, in the past we would have our internal team was the gatekeeper in terms of QA, but we worked with many more subject matter experts in the creation of content, and we're able to balance that quite a bit with generative AI doing content development. And then using our team and some subject matter experts in more of a quality review role. So that's been great. It's helped us on the dev side as well, in terms of speeding up a lot of our dev processes. So internally, we're using it a lot. The other area that's maybe a little unique to us is we're also having to think about how are learning outcomes in these courses changing because of generative AI. So, as an example, if you're taking a business communications course right now, that business communications course should be teaching you something about how you use generative AI. Because in the workforce, you're going to walk in and there's going to be an expectation you're using the tools that are available to you. And so, in almost every discipline, there's some change in what students need to learn and the capability students need to build. So, we need to bring that into our courses as well. And then the last piece is how do we use generative AI to help do things like, we've implemented or testing a range of smart tutors. We are implementing and using a range of tools for faculty members to be more efficient with their time in. I said a lot of faculty members do really like to customize materials. They particularly like to customize their exams. And so, how can we use generative AI to help them do that more efficiently? And so, there's just a lot of opportunity, I think, in all three of those. How do we work more effectively as a company? How do we help our customers use generative AI? And how do we use that differently in product? And all three of those, I think, have been really positive changes for us.
Fantastic. Kudos to you for being an early adopter. I know there's still a lot of companies that are trying to figure out how they're going to incorporate the technology into their offering. But with that, I'm curious, so you're really close to the space. Any forecasts on something to come and how AI may have the ability to disrupt higher education?
There's certainly been quite a bit of disruption in higher education from AI, and I think the providers who were hit first were providers who were simply providing access to resources, and those resources were behind a paywall, versus providers who were trying to solve a problem with resources and other services and supports. And so that distinction, and you look at public companies that fall into that category. I mean, Chegg definitely had a major market correction because it was so easy for students to say, I'm not going to pay a subscription to access information that I need for my course. I'm just going to go to ChatGPT. And so, or other tools that students were able to use. So I think there's definitely been some correction in our space. I think the thing that institutions are struggling with most is this question of questions of academic integrity. I ask you to write an essay. Are you writing the essay? Is ChatGPT writing the essay? In a world where we're using these tools so much more, what should students learn to be doing? And so instead of saying using ChatGPT is cheating, saying using ChatGPT is going to become as common as somebody using Microsoft Word to write an essay. So how do we help understand what students need to be learning to do that well, to do the right kind of review and refinement of that? That's a lot of, I think, the struggle within education right now is this kind of tension between keeping AI out as a cheating tool versus bringing AI in to shift the capabilities and learning students are going through to better prepare them for a world where AI is becoming pervasive. And we're still in that, we're still in that push and pull. So there's still, I think, a struggle with faculty members and truthfully all of us trying to understand how things are changing and what kinds of new tools are needed to assume use of AI instead of prevent and correct against use of AI.
Yeah, really well said. You can absolutely see how it's just a matter of time, or time will dictate what the acceptance looks like. And you're right. I mean, if it can give you a starting point for an essay or a paper, that's a good question. Is that, obviate the point of going to school, or is that just a great way to get started because it's helping, shape thought, and then you just need to refine it. Kim, it's been a great podcast. One of the questions I love to ask all of our guests before we wrap up is, if you had an opportunity to go back and have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
I think I would want to just share some of the perspective around how much learning is ahead. The idea of like the more open I've been to learning from others in any phase of Lumen's growth, the more successful Lumen's been. And the more I felt like I needed to have all of the answers, or that we didn't have the answers, and so some things were kind of out of bounds for us. I think those have been the places that we've had that we've been limited. If you're trying to lead a high growth company, you have to grow faster than the company to be the right leader for the next phase. And I think coming into it, I felt like I needed to have more of the answers. And I would just go back and say, get really, really good at learning and get really comfortable with making decisions that are not the best, and learning how to improve and iterate and make them the best. Because if you're growing quickly, things are moving fast. And the only way to get through that is to keep moving, make riskier choices, learn from those choices, iterate on that, use all of the resources around you, ask for help before you need it or as quickly as you start to realize that you need it. The idea of a founder just kind of going into the garage and pounding out a product that creates success all around the world. I don't think that's if that's ever happening at this stage of our kind of economic development, it is very rare. It's much, much more common that we're all having to just learn very quickly and do a lot of testing and trying and refinement and revision in every aspect of the business, from product to sales and marketing to culture and team. There's just a lot of learning that happens through that process.
No, I think that's brilliant insight. I have encountered instances where people wait for perfect information, and it's just, you know, if it exists, it's too late. The markets are.
I don't think I believe it exists anymore. I think it's just like you're doing the best you can with, at best, good enough information is the goal.
Yeah, action. Love it. Well, Kim, thank you so much for being on the podcast. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Our website's lumenlearning.com, and I'm Kim at Lumen Learning, so feel free to reach out.
Fantastic. Well, this has been another episode of the Innovators and Investors podcast. Kim Thanos, founder and CEO of Lumen Learning, thank you for being on the podcast. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Appreciate you, Christian.
Yep. And I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinTrap Management. Thank you for joining us.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.